Today's episode of the Film Stage Roundtable is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Roundtable. This, of course, is the spin-off podcast of the film spin-off podcast. Ooh, it's a Thursday, and it is already going real well over here. The spin-off podcast of the Film Stage show. Here we don't do full reviews. Instead, we talk about topics related to film culture as a whole. I, of course, am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello.
And Bill Graham.
Woo!
Woo, indeed. It is the first normal roundtable in a while. The last time we spoke with you, we had the Stagies, which have swept the world and caused quite a hubbub. We were definitely part of the conversation on Little Gold Men, so... there's always that.
Oh, really?
No, I'm 100% joking. No one gives a shit about us.
What about the Stagies? That was a big moment.
Yeah. You would think so. You would think
there was no semblance of sarcasm when you said that. So I, you know, to be fair, you said that totally deadpan.
My humor is a dry humor. from me drinking so much Zinfandel. So here we go. It's our first time back in a while.
Okay, wow. Yeah.
And the world continues to get crazier, and as it does, so too do we. So apologies in advance if this is a particularly loose and crazy episode. What we do here is we talk about things that are not direct reviews of films, and we kind of, you know, just chat it out, figure out what's going on in the world at large, because we talked about John Wick. And because we had a 50, this is actually pretty great. We had the 50 best action films of the new century. And someone on Twitter called our list one of the very worst lists that they had ever seen.
Cool.
So you should definitely go check that out. And because of that, we're going to be doing one action movie-related thing. And then because there's a new FX TV show out that everyone's making a lot of noise about, we're going to also review that. So, before we get into that, let me remind everyone to find us on iTunes, give us a comment and a rating, email us podcast@thefilmstage.com, and, of course, you can follow us on Twitter, @FilmStageShow, and Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. So, gentlemen, are we... pretty much prepared to go? Is everyone done eating?
No, but
no. That's fine. We're moving on.
All right. Well, here, you get a 1 minute long movie plug in order to be able to try to finish your food. We, of course,
I'm good.
We still got to do the movie plug. We are brought to you by Mubi. Mubi is a streaming online cinema site unlike any other, because unlike the Netflixes and Amazons of the world, Mubi actually has curators who go out of their way to find some of the best foreign, independent, and all-around great entertainment and bring it straight to your streaming device. That now includes Roku as well. And you have 30 days to watch every film they have before it disappears into the ether, so that means that you are getting a constantly refreshed, constantly curated list of great films to check out. They introduce a new film every day. Coming up soon, we have The Blue Angel, which is... This is their copy, so I'm not saying this. You know, you don't have to be worried about me speaking out of turn. It's their perverted Valentine Day special. And it is Joseph von Sternberg's masterpiece of relationship masochism with the indomitable Emil Jennings wilting under the sexy thumb of Marlene Dietrich in her career-making role. So if you're interested in checking that out, you can actually have a free 30-day trial of Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage and checking that out. And like I said, it's a free 30-day trial on us. All you have to do is give it a whirl, and I think that you will be hooked. That's again MUBI.com/filmstage. All right, now are you all done eating?
No.
No.
Well, that doesn't really matter that much. Guys, let's talk about Legion first. FX has been pimping this show for a while. The buzz has been getting crazy. And now it is time for the three of us to talk about what is one of the larger new TV shows to be released this winter.
Although not many normal people watched it. A lot of critics are certainly talking about it.
This is true. You know what, Bill? I reserve the right to be lazy every now and then.
You know, guys, the Pixies do have different songs.
No, like I know
Where Is Your Mind seems like the only song they've ever written. But there's other ones.
You know, you want to know what was really going to be fucked up is that at first I was thinking of finding the cover for Where Is My Mind that they used in Sucker Punch.
Oh, Jesus.
And I was going to deploy that shit on you. So you should be happy I went with the Pixies. I put this in because for all the tropes of madness that are in Legion, I thought it was very, very good of them to somehow avoid this song. So there is
true.
That. So what is Legion
about? Which is something that Mr. Robot could not avoid.
No. And the infallible leftovers used Where Is My Mind.
Really?
Yeah. It was
I would know nothing about that.
I'll give you a hint. It's when one character believed that they might be losing their mind.
Do you know what show has used Where Is Your Mind? And is better than all those shows that you already mentioned?
Legion?
The Americans?
No, The Americans.
Yeah.
I'm coming back in like 2 weeks.
Cannot wait.
I'm fucking pumped.
I'm so behind on that show.
Can you talk about how great it is that, like, if you really wanted to, you could look at everything happening in our national and foreign policy as like real heavy viral marketing for the Americans.
Yeah.
When the Americans first came out, the showrunners said, "I think there's enough distance between the Cold War and now that we can trust the American people to maybe root for this pair of Russian spies." When they said that, like 5 years ago, I don't think they could have predicted exactly what's going on right now. But who could have? Who could have predicted that?
And how would you summate what is going on right now, Brian?
Well, you know, since I dwell in the halls of power, since I am contracted by the federal government, I mean, I got some inside information. I could tell you some things, but I won't.
Hashtag fake news.
Oh, God. All right, so Legion. Legion. Legion is the newest show on FX, which, hey, is the network of the Americans. And Legion is about it's in the X-Men universe, but they're studiously avoiding saying anything about X-Men. But it is
true.
A Marvel TV show, and it does involve a mutant who is very powerful and who appears to have at least schizophrenia. And so the show does everything it can in order to put you into the fractured mind space of this primary character, and to kind of give you an inside view into what's going on with him while keeping you, the audience, in the dark about what is real and what is fake. So let's see what we thought about this. Michael, you had said that like a lot of critics were talking about this, but not a lot of people. Did it not get a big...
I thought it did.
No, the ratings were not great from what I remember. If either of you would like to go first, I can bring up the ratings
right,
for
let's
it.
Let's give it to Bill then. Bill, what did you think of Legion?
I thought it was absolutely gorgeous. I think this is one of my favorite pilots I think I've seen outside of Lost. I'm trying to think of some other. Mad Men is exceptional. Breaking Bad is also a really good one. But there are just some starts to some of these series that are just kind of out of the park home runs. They don't feel like pilots. They feel like something where it's been well honed and where it's very confident, because so many pilots just feel kind of slapped together, because that's literally how most pilots are. Most pilots are greenlit before the season is greenlit. Therefore, a lot of these pilots end up being kind of slapdash and a little bit lower budget than they would normally be. And this film, or this pilot, in its hour and a half television runtime, which roughly translates to probably about 50 to 60 minutes of airtime of actual television, I thought it was exceptional TV. It has a very, very Kubrickian feel to it that I absolutely adore. I love the way it's shot. I love the imagery, and I love the central mystery of David, who is in a mental institution when we find him and is kind of trying to figure out whether these voices in his head, these people around him that he sees, that he sometimes interacts with, are actually real. And there's a moment kind of in the pilot when he sees someone else interact with his visions that he kind of starts to, oh my God, you know, some of this is actually real. And I love that. I love the central mystery to it. And I think one of the most interesting things about this is that the pilot almost feels like the start, the setup for a trilogy of films. And it's one of what, like 12, 14 episodes that we're going to get this season. So it is really exciting the way it kind of ends and is set up for more intriguing kind of plot lines and to see where this world is going to go. This film, by and large, focuses on one person and one person only. Or I keep saying film. I'm sorry. That to me, that says so much about the TV show more than anything, right? But
I agree. It is a show, very cinematic show.
The show, one thing that it does so well, the pilot episode specifically, is it focuses on one person and really one person only. And in the next episodes, it kind of expands and we get a little bit more insight into the people around David. And so it's exciting in that way that this TV or episode is so insular. And then the second episode kind of expands it. And I'm curious to see how much further it expands from here on out.
All right, Michael Snydell, do you have those numbers for us?
I do. So Legion, this premiered with 1.6 million, which is the lowest like recent FX debut. I mean, comparing it to something like Americans, which is not, you know, which is also actually beloved by critics and has lower ratings, that had like 1.1 million for its last.
I'm actually surprised that the Americans has that many.
I am too, even though it makes me really sad, because
we already know that The Americans is going all the way to the end. They've said that.
Sure.
So that's good. Because for the longest time, The Americans was like the biggest source of stress
in
my life.
On the bubble. Yeah.
Do you know what Taboo is doing?
Yeah. Well, Taboo actually opened with, I don't know what it's doing week to week now, but its premiere was 1.8 million. Fargo was 2.7.
Oh, good. Nice.
And even things like Bastard Executioner, which I totally forgot about, was 2.1 million. Strain was 3 million. And American Crime Story is 5 million. And this is just a Deadline piece I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Right here.
Shocking, because there was so much marketing behind this. I feel like I couldn't get away from it. And as much as I love FX, they have this thing they do where they'll start advertising a show like 7 months before it comes out. And
yeah.
It's like, it's great if you don't know about the show and you're like interested, but if it's something you're already looking forward to, it becomes a little mean at a certain point. But so what did you think about this show, Mike?
Yeah, no, I kind of, I thought the pilot was okay, and then the second episode I really strongly disliked. So I guess I'm trying to figure out exactly what it is for me, but I think I Noah Hawley, the showrunner for this, is someone who's kind of a divisive figure. He was responsible for another superhero show back at NBC that ran for like a season, but then he's mostly known now for the two seasons of Fargo, the standalone series.
What do you mean by divisive? Because that show is universally
that is praised. That is not true. That is not true. Hmm.
Fargo?
No. Seriously, there are definitely people I know, who feel that Noah Hawley's shtick.
I'll look it up. You talk.
No, sure. I don't know whether I necessarily agree with the criticism, but the thing I have heard from a number of people, including friends who watched Fargo, is that they think he's a hack who has a great sense with presentation.
But there's like, you're talking about personal friends, but like by and large in the culture, like no one doesn't love Fargo.
That's not true. That is blatantly not true. I'm just telling you.
This is a 98% on the tomato meter. Rotten Tomatoes recently started using the tomato meter to start tracking TV and stuff like that. But so you're saying it is not universally praised, but it is absolutely not divisive.
It's a critical at all. Hit.
No, Noah Hawley is a figure that people have strong feelings about one way or the other.
Okay, because for the longest time I thought it was just the one way. But go ahead.
Yeah. All right. You know what? If you really want me to like name drop some critics, we'll do this after.
And Fargo season 2 is sitting at 100%. So
that's the one I really didn't like. I liked the first one. My point is that I bring this up because I am trying to parse out whether I don't like this because it's his style, whether I'm really tired of superheroes, or whether this show just isn't for me. And so I guess what I can say about this pilot episode, which we've all watched the pilot, so I won't really get into the second episode, is that Hawley and the cinematographer and the people that he brings with him who are doing production design, who are doing cinematography, who are doing camera movement. Like he has a sense, he has a very like sensuous style. Like it's all about sensory overload in the sense of characters. In the sense of characters are constantly reacting. There's constantly things going on. And then, also, the filmmaking is constantly moving forward with like these kinetic editing techniques and this, you know, asynchronous like nesting of time periods and things like this. And I just found in this first episode that layer of misdirection really exhausting. And by the end of that hour and a half, I really didn't give a shit about any of these characters. I think that Aubrey Plaza is one of the most annoying characters of the new season of television shows I've seen. I think that Dan Stevens is doing like a very traditionally twitchy version of a person with mental illness and schizophrenia, which I already feel weird about this. It's kind of weird that this, I was talking to somebody about this, but it's very strange that this came out, you know, like a month after Split, because they have very compatible views towards mental illness and how that can also be seen as a superpower and things like that. I guess what this boils down to me is that after watching two episodes, this thing still feels incredibly hollow to me. And I'm caught up in individual moments, you know, in the stylized slow motion and things like that. But it feels like a large bag of tricks that's just distracting me from the inability to just slow down and actually tell this story, especially in that first episode. It's just you are constantly being destabilized, and I am happy to see a show that plays with, you know, real and illusion. I mean, I've talked before about my love for Hannibal on here, but it's something about Howley's style, and I don't want to just credit it to Howley, but what I mean is that this is very much of a piece with Fargo season 1 and 2, in the sense that you have a lot of he knows how to get really good performances out of character actors. He knows how to make it look like there's some money in a scene, which is a good thing, but I still am skeptical about his abilities as a storyteller.
Well, I haven't seen any of the Fargo's seasons. I've obviously seen the movie, but that doesn't count. All I know is the universal deafening praise for his work. And so I walked into this show primarily because the promos were interesting, and then I heard good critical reception, and I'm a fan of Dan Stevens. So I'm going to split the difference here. I think that I haven't seen any of the second episode, so all I have to go on is the pilot, which is a very assured, very it's all of a piece. It doesn't feel like it's been network noted and everything. Like, this does feel like a very singular vision, for good and bad. I agree that there's sometimes a little too much given to the style that takes away from whatever emotional stakes there could be. But that being said, there are instances of emotion that make me feel like when the show wants to deliver on it, it can. It feels like an entire season of television happens in the first hour and a half.
Yep. Yeah. And that's that was my point about it feeling like the first of a trilogy of films, where you get done with it and you're like, whoa, when's the next movie, I guess.
Right. And here's the weird thing, though, is that it feels like, even though that is true, it feels like not a lot happens in it.
Yeah,
because sure. It's all set up, and there are moments, despite how frenetic this is, where it really slows down. And I thought to myself, like, I feel like maybe they could better spend time that they're spending reveling in this one thing on other things. That being said, though,
it's totally a thing that this is an hour and a half. And that exact point you made, like, if it was an hour, I might feel that less.
And I don't.
Oh, no, I'm Bill right now.
But I mean, my bigger thing was that at the end of the first episode, I was like, well, they seem to have cleared up the confusion. So what is the rest of this show going to be about? And I still don't know the answer to that, but I am interested to find out. I think that Dan Stevens is actually doing really good work here. He's a little twitchy, but I don't fully agree with you, Michael, about it feeling like something that I've seen before. I think that there's an earnestness and a gentleness to the performance that makes it better than just the stereotypical, like, spasming shoulders and twitching eye type of thing that we usually see in someone with schizophrenia.
Cough, 12 monkeys.
Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah.
I think Stevens has, like, a natural sweetness. I definitely agree.
And
I'm sorry, Brent. I'm interrupting.
Yes, you are, asshole. But no, you make a good point. He does. And in that way, he is very well cast. And in the montage that he shares with Rachel Keller, who plays Sid Barrett, it's just kind of beautiful the way that, you know, she won't let anyone touch her, and he respects that, and they kind of, like, find little ways to work around it. And I thought that was, like, a really good thing to do, but they rush it towards the end of the episode, and I thought I knew what this show was going to be, and then the last 5 minutes, it sort of upends its own premise and becomes something that feels very different. So I have a little trepidation about going on, but I'm super interested, and I like the fact that the television show is willing to go nuts. And I also is Syd Barrett named after Syd Barrett? Like, is that a thing that they?
I mean, they do a Pink Floyd needle drop. Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
Yes, it is named after them.
Okay, because I thought that was going to be a thing for a bit, and then I was like, maybe they just don't care. But like I said, so much of the mystery seems to have been dispelled by the end of that first episode that I didn't feel like I needed to come back. I was like, well, that seems to be over then, doesn't it? Because
it's almost satisfying as a complete episode, and you're just like, okay, I'm good. Yeah. Right?
Because it literally like, ends with him asking,
good miniseries, guys.
It literally ends with him like getting an information download and then him asking like, is this real? And then someone saying yes, and I love you, by the way. And it's like, okay, well, there's your arcs. Like, the show seemed to be setting up this question of what is reality and what really happened, but then it answers all that. So I'm at this weird crossroads where, like, I really enjoyed what I saw, but I'm not sure I need to see anything else. And I don't know what the hell's going on now. Like, at the end of The Americans, I knew what I was in for. I knew that I would be like spies and a marriage and all this other stuff. And even though there was a paradigm shift, I knew what I would be coming back for. But in this particular show, I'm not 100% certain what I'm coming back for. So I am going to give
This feels...
Go ahead.
This feels like a backdoor pilot in a lot of ways. It feels like this was an offshoot of a different television show. And that they're trying to set up a new show, and you're like, okay, but what is that new show going to be about? Like you remember when Better Call Saul was coming out, and everybody was like, what the fuck is that going to be about? like what is this thing going to be?
Yeah.
And then it came out, and people were like, holy shit, we love this, right? So I think that's kind of what the feeling they're going for in their own pilot. Which is like Brian is saying, it's so absurd, and yet it kind of works in a lot of ways to just kind of, if you're sold on that pilot, you're done for. You're in for the series.
But the only thing,
like, there's no doubt
think
at this
that
point.
You would come back for is what happens next. But like, I'm kind of happy with where it is now. Like, in terms of cliffhangers,
that's
not
fine.
Effective.
That's fine.
I could stop. I could stop right now and be like, all right, I saw that short.
So it's an anti cliffhanger for you. For me, it's just more like, I'm just like, oh, what's going to happen next?
But I guess, but like,
the only reason I want to go back is to find out whether these characters get developed, because there is no character development in that first time. Like, I'm amazed you guys remembered Syd's name, because I know literally nothing about this character
because
after spending 2.5
Barrett. I couldn't get over that.
I mean is, I spent 2.5 hours with this character, and I still have no idea who she is beyond her. I don't know if disorder is the
her
word I'm looking for.
Her aversion to touch?
Yes, her aversion to touch. Like, and that for some reason she has a thing for Dan Stevens. Like, I really have not a clue who any of these characters are, because the show spends so much time trying to emphasize these memories that so far don't really interest me. Like the second episode gets into this a little bit more and makes it a little bit more concrete of what the stakes are in that sense, but this first episode was just baffling to me. And like, I the whole time I'm, you know, it's cool to see so many different editing techniques. It's like a survey of every editing technique imaginable in that 90 minutes. But it's like, I don't know. I don't really know what this show's about.
I still don't know what the show is about, and I guess I'll figure it out when I watch it. But like, I can't imagine, like, I can't, you know, usually a pilot is something that's produced months before the rest of the show is produced. And so it has to hook a network executive and preview audiences into wanting to see more. This, they must not have gone to pilot. They must have gotten just a full series order right out of the gate, because I can't imagine someone producing this and saying, okay, great, everyone's going to want to know what happens next. Because you wouldn't. It's, the arc is done, as far as I'm concerned. Like, the emotional complexity of, like, oh, are these two crazy kids going to be able to make it work, appears to have been resolved. And the uncertainty about what is real and what is not likewise appears to have been resolved. So at the end of that first episode, like I said, I was just kind of, I was cool with it. Like, I don't really, what is up with Aubrey Plaza's character does not really invest me that much. And, you know, honestly, usually if a character finds love, I'm done with them. And it seems like David Haller has. So like, that seemed to be a big thrust of his. It was like this girl that he's in love with, but maybe she doesn't exist. But now, it really seems like she does. So I don't know what the fuck is going on.
You're putting a lot of confidence in the pilot solving all of these answers, when neither of us, or all three of us, have yet to see all of this episode. I mean, this could all come back. No, I mean this entire series.
Oh, okay.
All of this could all come back to end up unraveling on itself.
But that's not. I understand.
Brian,
what you're
is.
Whoa, hold on.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
One person at a time.
I want to say, Bill, like, I understand what you're saying, but that's something to seed in that first episode. Like, I should be coming back for confirmation, not waiting to see if it falls apart.
Okay, so here's the situation, right? I am absolutely sold on this character, and I want to follow his journey. And you are like, well, I'm done. So, it either works or it doesn't. So, Michael, it really didn't work at all.
I'm sort of with you, Bill, but I don't feel like I feel like it has worked out for him, and I'm good.
Okay,
like, I don't know that I need more affirmation. Michael, on the other hand, just never cared.
Yeah. No, it's
I do have to mention, I'm actually surprised. I guess we haven't found this out until now, or I haven't found this out until now, that you haven't seen a single episode of Fargo, Brian. I'm kind of baffled by that. It is absolutely one of the two best seasons of television that I've seen. Fantastic. And
that's not true.
Yes,
that's not true.
wait, Michael, you can't tell Bill that his personal ranking of seasons of TV is not right.
Michael, you are playing Brian's role way too hard right now. Right? Do not be an asshole.
First of all, my job.
I'm just gonna eat my food.
Yeah, you eat your food. You be quiet for the next minute or so. All right.
To your point, Bill, I want to see them, and I feel like I saw most of the pilot, but then I did that thing that happens to me sometimes where I miss one episode, and then, like, a man,
and then you wash your hands of it. You're like, okay, I'm satisfied.
No, it's more like like, have you ever, like, woken up one day and then realized that you haven't been to the dentist in like a year, and then you just kind of get scared and you don't go for like another year because you're worried about, like, the shame of it all? Like, that's kind of what I do with TV series, is like, soon it feels like I have to, like, confront a problem before I can really get back into it. So I kind of, like, gave up out of fear and embarrassment.
I understand, because right now in our kind of media saturated world, if you are an episode or two behind, it feels like the whole world has moved on without you. Yep. And you're like, wait, I only missed one episode. Like, can't I catch up? And it's like, no, you cannot. And she's like, oh, Jesus. Okay. I'm sorry. I'll go repent over in the corner and watch The Leftovers, I guess, or something else.
If you haven't yet, you really should. It's very good.
I know.
Coming back in April.
But I do want to say that Michael is right, that this show in particular feels very much like a Noah Hawley property. And I mean that in the best way, And Michael means that in the worst way. Take from that what you will. He plays with nonlinear kind of storytelling. He does voiceover while you're looking at a scene where a character is static, riding a bus, and you hear voiceover. He does very interesting editing. He will do a quad shot where you have four different images that you're tracking at one time. This guy is... He is kind of a wizard on the television screen, very much unlike a few other people out there. This guy is definitely a tour 101 if you want to kind of go down that rabbit hole.
Yep.
And so, you know, some people are like Michael that are just like, nope. But again, 97% and 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Are we really going to talk about what Rotten Tomatoes means? Because I can tell you about things that I didn't like that are still positive.
But Michael, you have to admit that there is a difference between you and some friends not liking it and the vast critical consensus.
Did I say that? I said divisive. That does not mean fast.
But it's not right, divisive.
Fine.
Yeah, if it's 50%, that's divisive. If it is widely praised or critically panned like on a large scale, that's kind of divisive.
I'll say 98%. If it's 80%, but that happens to be a particularly vocal 20%, it's still divisive.
Fine, I'm taking back my pronouncement. What I would say, Bill, is that. A tour quality that you're talking about as well. I think that again, like I can appreciate Howley, but he feels more like a technician to me. Like it's interesting you said wizard, because he does feel like someone who's tinkering to me and figuring out the story way later. And it is that coldly, that distance of the auteur, that feeling. Like, it's interesting that you mentioned Kubrick earlier, which I mean, I guess I can see the comparison there, but there is, especially Kubrick has a certain feeling that this has as well, which sometimes comes across as kind of clammy to me.
And okay. I think cold. Yeah.
Okay.
And when you combine that with like all of these peak TV elements, like just this sense of just this, as I said, you can feel the money in the show and it bothers me.
I have no idea
I can, agree in so far as the show feels very crafted, but not very felt. It doesn't, like, when I watch The Leftovers, like, that is an impeccably crafted television show. But more than anything, when I think of the creative forces of The Leftovers sitting around and coming up with ideas, I picture them talking, like, 90% emotion and then, like, 10% aesthetics. And I feel like, from word go, Legion was, like, the opposite. It was, like, 90% aesthetics and 10% emotion. And The Americans, similarly, I think that, like, maybe it's, like, you know, 70% emotion, 20% plot, and then 10% aesthetics. You know, I feel like the best shows on TV work emotion in as their cornerstone and their foundation. I mean, even Hannibal, I feel like every time that Hannibal was doing its thing, they were saying, like, but what is driving these people? What are they feeling? And I don't feel that at current with Legion.
Well, I think the one thing to
one of the things about Lost that made it so immediate was that you did almost immediately feel a great affection for these characters.
Sure.
And, you know, Mad Men, the same thing. Like, there was this weird humanism that you could feel, and you could tell that it wasn't just plot machinations. In fact, I defy almost anyone to tell me that the plot of Mad Men mattered. It was all about how it affected the characters. But at the end of Legion, it really did feel like, okay, come back and find out what happens with this weird war thing that's going on, rather than let's see if David is going to become better.
Sure.
Okay, let's move on.
Luckily, our second topic is not as intense as this one. It's a very simple one. We're going to, in the honor of John Wick and our 50 top action films of the new century, we're just going to go through and give our guilty pleasure action movie favorites. So, yeah, everybody ready?
I'll start.
No, we got to get music on. I just want to make sure that we're all ready.
Oh, okay. All right. We're fucking ready.
Now, who is the too cool for school asshole who sighed during a Motley Crue song?
No, it's not too cool for school. I just feel like every time I hear that song, I'm like transported to like a strip club or something, which is not a feeling I particularly like.
I will tell you, Michael, I worked for a couple months doing research for a book.
Oh, I thought you were going to say strip club.
No, for a book I was going to write on strip clubs, and they don't play music as good as Motley Crue at a strip club.
Okay.
Do you have strong feelings about Motley Crue, Brian?
No. In fact, that's why I just said, like, as a joke, I guess, again, my dryness is overwhelming my humor. Like, you'd be lucky to get a Motley Crue song. Oftentimes, the songs you do get are legitimately awful.
Well, that Pantera song, I know, is, like scientifically the most played song in strip clubs or something.
Which Pantera song?
Yeah, it's, my God. I can't think of the Pantera song.
Anyway, let's
give me one second, guys.
We are going to literally give Bill 1 second, and we will be right back with our picks of guilty pleasure favorite action movies. Nope, it's all staying in.
Okay, whatever.
No, we're definitely cutting it out.
I'm ready. I want to drop my two. I'm ready.
Wait, we're doing two?
No, we're only doing one.
I know, but I'm going to drop one.
Motherfucker, what are you doing?
I'm going to drop one to reference another the previous podcast that we've done on sharks, and then I'm going to bring up another one.
Sharks. Okay. Did we do a podcast on sharks?
Yes. Let's move on.
The Pantera song was Walk, by the way.
Okay. So, guilty pleasure action movie picks. Now, here's the thing. We had to talk about, like, what counts. Because, like, I'm going to say right now, a lot of people will be like, oh, Face Off. But, like, Face Off isn't a guilty pleasure. Face Off is a legitimately great film. Action movies walk a line. And I feel like I can say in a room full of people without shame, I fucking love Face Off. But there are certain films where, like, I have to preface it with, I know it's not a popular choice, but... Or after I say it and people start shouting at me, I immediately have to defend myself. So we're not talking about goofy fun, oh, they change faces. We're talking about things where you know the minute you say it, you're in for a fight. So let's kick it off with possibly shark-based Bill Graham.
Yeah. All right, so my first one is going to be Deep Blue Sea, because I get a lot of people that just want to groan and gripe and just say that is a flat-out terrible film.
They're wrong.
Yeah. What did you say, Brian?
I said it's a dumb movie, but it's
okay.
It's not bad.
It is so damn enjoyable. But I expunged... Is that the word? Yes, I think so.
I don't have the full context, but I can tell you when you're done your sentence if you chose the right word.
If you will let me finish, I will finish. I expunged a lot on this film in our...
Expounded.
Expunged is not what you want, man.
Expounded on this film when we reviewed... the way
the Shallows.
Yeah, Shallows. Yes. So because we all had our favorite shark film in that podcast, and I went off on a tangent about Deep Blue Sea, about how much I had loved it.
Water.
Yes. But my favorite kind of groan-inducing film from a lot of people is still Deep Rising, Stephen Sommers classic. What?
Oh,
what? Did I pick yours?
No, but I'm definitely having the reaction that we talked about. That is such a shitty movie.
Yes! See? I love it so much. It's so much fun, Brian.
This is like the second time we've talked about this movie.
I don't remember
that. I'm 100% sure we talked about this because I remember that it had Treat Williams and Famke Janssen.
Yes! Yes!
I remember talking about it, but I don't know why. But
maybe this is the second time I've talked about it on this podcast, and I love that that's the possibility. Stephen Sommers is my man. Look, he made Deep Rising. I love this film so much. It's so stupid. It's so fun. It is a bottle episode in a movie. It's all on this stupid boat that just happens to be just like completely left alone from, or like, it's almost like it's a ghost ship, right? Because they come on and they're ready to raid it. Yeah, they're ready to raid it, and they're like they're a bunch of pirates, and they're about to raid the ship, and they're like, all right, we're going to like get all these people, and they're going to have all this money, and they get there, and it's dead, and nothing is there, and they're just like, why is no one here? Like, why is this cruise ship just kind of hanging out with nobody piloting it, nobody doing anything? Like, it's just kind of dead in the water. And slowly they uncover that there is a sea creature fucking terrorizing the ship, and it just goes flat out bananas from that point on. It becomes Aliens in a lot of ways, but a very cheap B-movie Street Fighter with Jean-Claude Van Damme level B-movie ripoff of Aliens. A lot of people have mentioned that it feels like a ripoff of Aliens. It definitely is a ripoff of Aliens, and I love it so much. It's so much fun.
Bill, I'm looking at a poster for Deep Rising. The tagline is "Full Scream Ahead."
Yes.
I remember watching this movie, and I feel like it was right when it came out. Which means I was like 11 or 12, and it's R-rated, so I don't know what my parents were thinking exactly. Oh, yeah. But, holy shit, man. Even an idiot child, I, like, hated this movie.
I love it.
Good choice for all the wrong reasons.
One bonus one real quick. I will also mention that, Stephen Sommers did kind of hit peak with The Mummy and maybe The Mummy Returns, and then he just ground out with a score or screenplay credit with Scorpion King and then Van Helsing, which was just flat out terrible. But he renewed his faith, or my faith in him, with G.I. Joe, which is actually the better of the two G.I. Joe movies.
Not Rise of Cobra.
No, it is The Rise of Cobra.
That's the first one?
That's the first one.
Oh, Jesus.
Yep.
I don't know.
Yep. Sorry.
Look, I'm not good with the G.I. Joe movie names. I'm not great with the Fast and Furious names. And I'm really terrible with the...
with the mummies? The
monkey ones. No, the Planet
of the
Apes.
Wait, dude, you're really saying the first one is better than the second G.I. Joe?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that second movie is trash.
I know. Well, I was doing a drinking game to the first movie, and I almost had to stop just out of...
Awesome. All right, well, Bill Graham kicked us off with a... guilty of murder is, the most guiltiest of pleasures, Deep fucking Rising. Let's see what Michael Snydell does.
Well, you know, Bill, you're kind of a motherfucker, because you said mine.
Oh, really?
I also picked a Stephen Sommers movie.
Oh no! Yes. Wait, which one?
And I picked the mummy.
You picked the mummy.
Oh yeah. Wait, no, the mummy's so enjoyable.
Wait a second. Yeah, I think people like the mummy, don't they?
All right, people. All right, it has a 56% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Right.
Shit, I'm literally using Rotten Tomatoes after just. Yeah. No, wait, I prepared this. All right. What I would say is that I think people would say, "Oh yeah, it's fun, and it's fine." I've probably seen The Mummy 25 times, and I really enjoy it literally every time.
It was, for a time, it was on network network television, like, every day during, like, a summer. And I must have seen, like, bits and pieces, like, 30-minute chunks of that film, like, I don't know, like, 100 times. Like, I saw that film so many times, and I was just like, why is this movie it's like The Avengers on FX. Whenever you watch something now, like, you record, and, like, the last half of the first episode or whatever you're watching, like, the last 5 minutes is always The Avengers. It's always them eating shawarma. It's just like, why is Avengers on so much? And it's just like, yeah, that was The Mummy for a while. All right, go ahead. Sorry.
I'm just shocked because, like, I don't think I've ever been, like, castigated for liking The Mummy. Like, I thought that was one of those movies from our childhood that, like, people kind of got behind.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they are,
too,
but
and
I would
especially
literally...
since it spawned more of them, right?
That's not a metric of quality. Anyway, Michael, go ahead. Talk about this nonsense.
Yeah, no. I thought you said you weren't going to give me shit about this one, Brad.
Did I say that? I said that I don't think you deserve shit, but I'm still going to give it to you. Otherwise, what are we all doing here?
That's a good point. Yeah, no, what I'd say is I actually caught it about a year and a half ago on, like, TNT or whatever, which also plays it just as much as The Avengers, as Bill was saying. But, yeah, no, this is, like, a way creepier movie than I think a lot of people give it credit for. Like, I don't know, in the same way that something like Gore Verbinski's The Ring is kind of underrated for its atmosphere, I was kind of surprised rewatching The Mummy, you know, how dark it gets, especially in that second half.
There's a point where there's, like, a guy who, like, has no eyes or tongue, and he's, like, still alive. I remember as a child feeling really bad for that guy.
And there's just a lot of a little surprising emotional beats in there, like the one that's coming to mind randomly right now is one of his friends in the Air Force who all of his friends have died, but he hasn't been shot down yet. Like, he's ready to die, but he's not going to die unless it's in the line of duty. It's like this one-off character who's in two scenes, but it's, like, surprisingly moving.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have Brendan Fraser is not someone I love, but I think he's really good in this, especially how he starts so, like, it's such a small transition, but how he starts so damn scrubby, and then he's just, you know, like Hollywood action hero two scenes later. Like, I think this movie, I would not stand up for Steven Sommers as a director. I think Van Helsing is garbage. I think G.I. Joe, obviously, as I said, is interminable. But I think The Mummy is even better than the reputation it has for being a guilty pleasure. I feel weird saying very good genre film, but you know what? Fuck it. Yeah. I really like this movie. So I guess that's why it's maybe a guilty pleasure for me.
Going hard in the paint.
I was about to say, so
for,
like,
Steven Sommers, this is a weird night.
All right. Well, I'm going to do even weirder. I was influenced to suggest this topic because of a conversation we had on the John Wick episode, wherein I mentioned Timur Bekmambetov.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yep.
I could choose almost any of his films.
Oh no, Brian.
I think you could say like the Night Watch and Day Watch movies.
This is about a motherfucking president. I swear to God, Brian.
I'm trying to speak gentleman. So I could have talked about the Night and Day Watch movies, but those are foreign and based off of a novel, and I've read the novel, oddly enough, and they're pretty good. I don't feel like I ever have to do anything. I think that one of the weirder things is that no matter how fucked up a movie is, if it's in a different language, people are willing to give it a pass. So it's like, it's really weird. And then I could do Wanted, but Wanted, I feel like I've met enough people who are like, oh yeah, Angelina Jolie shooting bullets to the side. That's a fun movie.
There is a moment in Wanted when he slides over the car and he's shooting at the same time that I was just like, I remember being in the theater and just like cheering. I wanted to get up out of my seat and start like clapping. I was just like, yes, I'm into this.
That movie doesn't give a flying fuck, and it is beautiful to behold.
It's fun.
The movie's good in the same way as like a Shoot 'em Up.
Right.
Like
I thought about Shoot 'em Up for a bit. But I've never shown Shoot 'em Up to someone and then had them like hate me for it, because when people are willing
unlike
to give Shoot 'em Up a try,
Abraham Lincoln.
What was that?
I said unlike Abraham Lincoln.
Unlike, actually, when I went and saw this movie in theaters with friends, they all liked it too. Abraham
what?
Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Oh God damn it!
So,
Bill, we need to slack him.
Abraham Lincoln.
I don't know if I have the energy. I spent it all going off on Deep Rising.
Abraham Lincoln stars Benjamin Walker as Abraham Lincoln, 16th President of the United States. And it involves him hunting vampires. Now,
oh, Jesus Christ.
When I heard this, I was like, this is a hilariously terrible idea. And I cannot
wait to watch American
it.
Psycho on stage, Brian.
Yeah, I do.
Okay. I will admit I talked to who is the vampire that's helping him out. I can't remember his name right
Dominic
now, the actor.
Yes,
I talked to Dominic Cooper right before the film came out, and we were talking about Timur Bekmambetov. And we were talking about like his crazy eye for like visuals and things like that. Now, this was before the film was released, and Cooper was just like ecstatic. He was having so much fun, just kind of reveling in like the way that the set was run and just like the depiction of things. And I was kind of with this movie until the fucking horses. Oh my god.
Okay, yeah. I cannot as much as I stand up for this movie, the horses scene is a little, I feel like fucked over there on the budget.
The budget, but also just rein it in.
If you know you're not gonna be able to pull it off, don't do it. But I want to stand up for Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, because the hand to hand action and the more grounded, quote unquote, heavy scare quotes on that actually, fight scenes are all very good. And one of the things that I
he wields an axe exceptionally well.
God, when the whole like them in the woods and it's like chop down this tree and he has to like just focus real hard. And then he can cut down a tree with a single swipe. It's but it's so fun. And even more than that, there's like a real fucking earnestness to this movie. Like
there is.
It's not like Meet the Spartans or some shit. Like they take this story idea so goddamn seriously, and they really like put the pedal to the metal in terms of like, let's take this to its utmost degree. Let's say that the South is run by a cabal of vampires who are using the slave trade for a ready food source. And that is one of the more subversive, like really bold allegorical takes on the slave trade in America that you've ever seen in a movie.
You need to write this think piece, Brian.
Oh, do you think didn't already?
Yeah.
I have on my computer in front of me. the review that I wrote for my personal site, dearfilm.net, about Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. And
did you read the book?
No, I did not.
Okay.
This, I apparently wrote this like right after the movie was released in 2012. And I said, it's not just, first of all, when I first began dearfilm.net, I actually wrote letters to the films. Like, I addressed the films. Nice. So I first awarded it some points for like really sticking with the biography of Abraham Lincoln and like not, again, huge scare quotes, fudging the facts of his life. And then I said, but it's not just the biographical aspects of Lincoln's life that you work with. Your whole story is predicated on the brewing questions of slavery in the South and the growing rift between the Union and the coming Confederacy. You tackle the ideas of liberty and slavery, not just allegorically, but with full-throated reality. There's something noble about this combining of fact and fiction. I don't feel as though you belittle the reality of slavery or undermine the truth behind the Civil War. Rather, you overlay a strange amount of logical vampiric deviousness over the real-life events. You evince a supernatural conspiracy theory, yes, but you do so with such actual purpose and intellect towards the reality of our past that it never felt exploitative. Actual words written by me nearly 5 years ago about this movie.
Who knew you were such a vulgar artist?
Yeah. I said, you actually do a strange kind of honor to the memory and idea of Abraham Lincoln. You act as a natural exploitation of the best parts of Honest Abe. His bravery, his idealism, and his commitment to unity and equality. Into their logical conclusion, should vampires have ever existed? Like, it's like, let's not belittle this man or change this man. Let's take what he believed and apply it to vampires. He battles against the exploitation and subjugation of people who cannot defend themselves, and he never backs down in the face of a greater foe. He stands on principle and remains undeterred by tragedy and strife. So, yeah.
What the fuck was that? What did you just do? You just read your full-length review.
No, I read two paragraphs out of my full-length review. Okay. I don't know how long this is, but I got pretty verbose. So,
and here I thought the press conference would be the biggest gibberish I heard all day.
Okay. Let's take this point.
But like every time, like you guys, playing into the premise of what a true guilty pleasure is, before I'd even given a firm hint as to which one I chose, you started giving me shit about this. But this is a good movie.
Congratulations.
Okay. I'll admit there are, in the pantheon of bad movies where it's just like bad situation after bad situation after bad situation, this is not one of those films. The start of this film, I remember kind of being into it. I remember having a lot of fun with kind of the idea. Mary Elizabeth Winstead as Mary Todd Lincoln, or I guess Mary Todd at first, she's having a lot of fun with it. Anthony Mackie's in it, like
Jimmy Simpson.
Rufus Sewell. Oh yeah, Jimmy Simpson. Like, man, Martin Soskus is in it. Man, this movie's got a lot of people. They're doing their damnedest to kind of sell this this idea.
And they play it straight.
And it's fun at first, but it just absolutely falls off the rails towards the end, in my opinion. I think it, it hits absolute rock bottom in that sequence with the horses, which is just an absolute disaster of a sequence. I think I saw this film in 3D. And I remember taking off my 3D glasses, looking at the screen, squinting, putting them back on, and saying, nope, that's the movie.
Still bad.
That's how bad that sequence is. And I don't think it really gets a whole lot better, because from that point on, if I remember correctly, there is a train sequence and there's like things that are burning, and so like there's a bunch of soot and ash falling through the sky.
Bill, let's talk about the CGI quality of the tentacle monster in Deep Rising, shall we?
No. That movie was made on a very low budget. It was made a long time ago in the 1990s. Wow, really?
Yeah, I looked it up.
That's a lot of money back then.
And then,
guys,
yeah,
I'm watching the horse scene
and then,
without sound right now. It is, yeah.
And then Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter was $69 million.
Wow, what? What is that? That doesn't make any sense. How does Deep Rising cost $45 million? And in these inflated budget times that we live in, this movie cost $69?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. That
blows my mind.
So cheap. But again, I think that it maybe they should have like not done that. I'm going to look up what $45 million.
Should have not done that.
Well, I think that they should have said like this just isn't going to work. But so $45 million in 1998 in 2012 would have gotten you. Please use values less than $10 million. Apparently, my CPI inflation calendar is not working. Apparently $63.3 million.
Oh,
so they are about on
right
par.
Around. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So
anyway,
I will take my CGI sea monster over your horse scene any day of the week.
That is your prerogative because that is your guilty pleasure. And again, everybody loves the mummy, so cowardly Michael doesn't have to deal with any of this shit.
No, I found Abraham Lincoln really boring. I didn't really care about the CG. Like,
okay.
That,
well, that's fine.
That's less of a problem to me.
You want
to
know what's funny, though?
I think on
IMDb, on the frequently asked questions about Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, one of their frequently asked questions is, what is Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter about?
Is it about him hunting vampires?
I don't say this often, but that person is too stupid to live. Okay, are we done? Okay, I apologize to anyone who decides to watch Deep Rising or Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter because of us.
But no, you... please write in. Please, yes.
Go watch The Mummy, though. It's great.
Everyone agrees The Mummy is great. It's got Brendan Fraser at the height of his power.
In his only good role.
I like him in Monkey Bone.
I like him in Encino Man.
All right.
I heard that sentence before.
I figured out our topic for next time. It's Guilty Pleasure Brendan Fraser movie.
Have you guys ever seen Extraordinary Measures with Harrison Ford and Brendan Fraser?
I'm already working around the clock. Anyway. That's it for today. Thank you for joining us.
I feel bad for anyone who listens to this podcast.
Feel free to tweet us. We didn't tweet this out ahead of time. I kind of lost track of what was going on in my life. So we don't have any Rockin' Robins this time. But if you'd like to, tweet at us what your guilty pleasure favorite action movie is.
And it has to be below like 50% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Just make sure it's the type, it's the type of thing where like you're embarrassed to say it at parties. Like where if you're trying to impress someone, you wouldn't tell them that right away.
Yes. If someone was like, isn't blah, blah, blah such a piece of shit? You would not be like, no. Yeah, you would put your hand down. You'd be like,
You have to literally either feel or be made by other people to feel guilty about liking this movie. So
I definitely had that happen.
I feel like action movies is a weird thing. Like, I think there's a lot of other genres that you could answer this with easier than with action films. Because I think action films, like, lend themselves pretty well to either serious interpretation or campy interpretation, things like Roadhouse,
for instance. I got a lot of shit for liking Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, so what does that tell you?
Be better, Brian. Be better.
And you can find my review of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter on my personal site, dearfilm.net. Before we go, let me remind everyone that we are brought to you by MUBI, the online streaming cinema. For your free trial of MUBI, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Every day, MUBI gives you a new, wonderful film to watch, something that you won't have to feel guilty about. So go check out their selection, and then go to our special website there. That is mubi.com/filmstage, and you will get a free 30-day trial. And again, don't forget that they are now operating a Roku app, which is as beautiful as it is wonderful. So mubi.com/filmstage for your 30-day trial. MUBI. New year, still no tagline. That's it. For anyone out there who would like to get in touch, remember, it's at Film Stage Show. Search Facebook for The Film Stage Show, podcast at thefilmstage.com. And if you have any ideas for things that you would like us to talk about, all you have to do is write them on a bullet and then shoot that bullet into a curve so that it slams into a tree outside my house, cutting it down, and I'll go and find it.
You're not going to call the cops about that?
No, I'm cool.
Maybe seize the bullet curve.
You've got to curve the bullet. That's the if I find out that that bullet went straight into that tree, God help you. It must be curved. Gentlemen, let's tell the fine folks at home where we can be found between now and the next time we speak. Bill Graham.
I can be found furiously searching Amazon, wondering why I cannot buy Deep Rising on Blu-ray by itself, but only as part of a duology or trilogy or quadrilogy of films on Blu-ray, often paired with Puppet Masters, and I don't know why.
I was hoping that it was like a bunch of different sequels of Deep Rising.
No, it unfortunately is not. But yeah, this is the only way that I apparently can get this film on Blu-ray. I cannot buy it on its own. That tells you so much about this film, and it breaks my heart.
You can get it on a 4-pack with Deep Rising, Puppet Masters, When a Stranger Calls, and Happy Birthday to Me.
I have no idea what those movies are.
Wait, dear,
why is it not called The Puppet Master? Why is it a sequel?
I guess there's more than one. And Michael, it does not look like it's the original.
No, that
okay,
is not.
Happy Birthday to Me seems amazing. It's just okay. A picture of a person putting a kebab through the back of his head.
Dear mother of God.
You can find me you can find me on Twitter at CableBFG lamenting this fact. You can also find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and also freshfiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, where I will nitpick the stupidity of Rotten Tomatoes.
Using it to bolster your own points.
Exactly. In the most appropriate
way. We contain
way
multitudes, guys. We contain multitudes.
Go to hell.
Sure, let's go. Let's go with that. Sometimes I write things. At places like The Film Stage and Paste. Just watch my Twitter. Things will be coming.
Oh my God. No one has ever been worse at just plugging my shit.
I know. You're telling me.
It's incredible.
You don't have to have something snappy every single time. You can just roll with it.
All right. You can find me expounding upon the allegorical significance of the axe that Abraham Lincoln uses in Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter on Twitter, where I am at Brian J. Rowan. And, of course, you can find all my other writing and stuff at my personal site, dearfilm.net. Don't forget to check out our 50 best action films of the new century list at The Film Stage. I also have a review of A Cure for Wellness that is up, and tomorrow morning when this comes out, you will also be able to read my review of My Happy Family, which is getting a lot of good festival buzz. So, that is that for now. We will be doing Cure for Wellness next time you hear us on this podcast, so go check that out if you please. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next time.